Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. We'll be talking a lot about the brain on this episode. My guest is Dr. Elaine Behrer. She's a neuropathologist at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine and is the Harvey Family Professor in Pathology. Her work includes studying biomarkers of trauma and abuse in children. She has also been researching whether the cause of Alzheimer's disease may come from infections. Dr. Behrer is also a composer, and it was music that spurred her interest in studying the brain. She was interested in pursuing science in college, but her high school guidance counselor informed her that women don't do science. Fortunately, she found a way to study computer science and music together at Carnegie Tech and later got a bachelor's degree from the Manhattan School of Music. She also has a master's degree in musicology and an MD-PhD. Dr. Behrer spoke to me by Skype from the California Institute of Technology, where she is a visiting professor. What was it about music that made you wonder about the brain?
Well, I was interested in both science and music, and it seemed to me that how we experience music had a lot to do with how our brain works. And many people tried to figure out the physics of sound and the physics of our sensation of sound over the past 2,000 years. But we don't really know how all of that sound information that we perceive gets integrated into a musical experience. So as I started writing music when I was 6 years old, and I've continued doing it, I'm writing a piece right now. And I wanted to know, well, if I write music, what happens to the listener? How does my music experience, how is it experienced by the listener? And then I also started thinking, where is this music that I hear in my head all the time? Where is that coming from?
So I know you are a neuropathologist. What does that mean in terms of your research focus?
Pathologists are so fundamental to everything doctors do. The pathologists run the clinical labs that test your blood, test your urine, any kind of bodily fluid or pathogen aren't done in pathology labs. Pathologists run those labs, understand all those tests, can explain everything to the managing physician. Pathologists also do autopsies, and they get the whole history of a person's life when they do the autopsy, and they can follow what has happened and how it has happened and how did it turn out. And pathologists work very closely with surgeons and look at all the tissue that comes out of a human body is passed through the pathology department and examined by a pathologist. Okay. So pathology training is the basic science of pathologic process, of disease process. And I found that fascinating. And so I continue to do it.
One of your research projects at UNM has focused on biomarkers for child abuse. What propelled you to explore that issue?
Oh, wow. As a neuropathologist, I've been part of the team that meets to look at the brains of everybody who dies in New Mexico. So the New Mexico Office of Medical Investigator, all of the deaths in a 400-mile radius are examined at our Office of Medical Investigator, and I've had the opportunity to participate in the brain cutting conference. And what we see there are the children who have died in New Mexico. New Mexico has a very high rate of childhood deaths from abuse, from maltreatment, and sometimes we rank highest or worst in the nation for the number of deaths per year that we see per population. So I just became fascinated by, what about all the kids who didn't die? And is there a way to pick up on this before they die, then find out whether they're being abused at home and or in whatever living situation they have? And can we detect that early and do something about it? So that's where the idea came from.
What does this mean? What did you find in terms of actual physical biomarkers in the brain for child abuse?
Right. So we don't want to do a brain biopsy, right? So we try to look at some peripheral tissue that will be serve as a proxy for blood or for brain. Another tissue we're exploring is hair. So it turns out that when a child is stressed, the stress hormones go into the roots of their hair. And we can cut little pieces of hair and test whether they have stress hormones in it and if those stress hormones are normal levels or heightened. And it turns out that witnessing domestic violence or being a victim of abuse causes a lot of stress hormones to be found in hair. And then instead of doing blood, which I thought was, kids don't like having their blood taken, I thought we could look at saliva. So saliva has blood cells in it, and it has cheek cells that are shed from the inside of the mouth, from the cheek, and the tongue, and the mucous membranes inside the mouth. So and kids don't mind spitting at all. They'll spit all day. You say, "Here's a spit cup," and they spit. They love it. And we give them sugarless lollipops to increase their saliva, so they like that too. So we've been able to collect a lot of saliva from children who've been referred, actually here in Los Angeles, to a not-for-profit intervention institute called Children's Institute, Inc., that provides support for the families and helps the child recover. And so we've gotten a lot of saliva, and we've been able to do a pilot study on that, as well as some saliva from the emergency room at UNM. And that has shown us that there are changes in the salivary methylation pattern, which is complicated to explain. Some of the stress hormones activate the blood cells to change their expression because they're prompting them to respond to a traumatic event. And so we can see this change of the expression in these immune cells in the saliva. And we can see that the child has experienced some frightening event because the fear is what prompts the change in these white blood cells. So we found, I don't remember exactly how many sites that were changed. My graduate student, Brianna Mulligan, she's a computer science graduate student at UNM, presented this as a platform talk and as a news media release last November at the Society for Neuroscience. And our paper is in press. It's supposed to come out in print version in October, but I think it was e-published last summer because I'm getting notices that it's already been cited a lot. So we're trying to look at how can we check a child's spit or hair and know whether they're at risk for some worse trauma and intervene early. If a child is undergoing chronic stress, their expression changes in their white blood cells. We know that they become more susceptible to infection. They have trouble concentrating in school. There's lots of things that go along with high stress. So whether the child presents with a traumatic injury or not to the ER, if we see a child in our regular clinic or in the ER that has this high stress, we need to do some kind of intervention to fix that problem. One of the things that's been happening in the Netherlands that some friends of mine have told me, they have some projects looking at all kindergartners as they come to school, and they're testing their hair for cortisol. And if they have this stress hormone in their hair, they're providing family support because they realize that children just can't learn very well if they're in a high stress and stressed out situation.
How do you think these findings might shift the thinking on the impact of child abuse on children, but also as they mature into adults?
So one of the reasons we do this annual child well-being symposium at UNMHSC is to bring together the team that we need for this kind of question to be properly addressed. We need the community. We need social workers. We need child psychologists. We need family counseling. And we also need help for our most impoverished families. So some types of childhood stress just comes from poverty, and it's not anybody's fault.
I read in an article about this research, one early childhood advocate, was so excited about this. She said it could save thousands of lives.
Yes, it's also when we look towards the future, and this brings up the whole immigrant problem. And this morning there was an article in the New York Times about how these immigrant children who are still being kept from their parents, what is the consequence on their mental development, and what kind of adults are we creating by separating these children from their parents? So we have to think about the future of our society. And when we have a high rate of child abuse, we're going to have a high rate of criminality, delinquentism, drug abuse, alcoholism, all sorts of things that come out of having a limited and abusive childhood. So it really is something we need to think about and find ways to manage much better than we do now. The work in my laboratory right now is focused on a mouse model of early life stress. And we've been imaging, and that's what I'm doing at Caltech, we've been imaging the brains of mice that have been exposed to early life stress by maternal deprivation. And we're finding, because we can do MR imaging, we can look at the whole brain, and we can use genetically identical mice with identical environmental experiences throughout life, we're finding that the brain activity is changed, and the response to fear is very different in mice that have not had maternal attention in the first 3 weeks of life than mice who have been normally nurtured.
And our mice brains, I know they're used a lot because they're somewhat comparable in many ways to human brains.
Well, so my belief is that it's the limbic system, which is the emotional pathways in the brain that are affected by early life, because those are more developed than other parts. But what's really interesting is that the serotonergic pathways develop during the first 3 weeks of life, as do the adrenergic pathways. So these are the two limbic system pathways that most respond to fear and to pleasure. And they're developing in these early, in this early life period, and humans probably up until age 2 or 3. That development is happening when the child is in your arms, it's playing in its playpen. And probably the reason that develops late, the evolutionary explanation for that, might be that they do need to change according to our environment. They do need to respond to environment, but not to a severe environment, more to the general environment of a normal child's upbringing.
This is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick, and I'm speaking with Dr. Elaine Bearer. She's a neuropathologist at UNM who has researched biomarkers for child abuse, as well as how infections might be a cause for Alzheimer's. She's also a composer. Her love of music spurred her interest in studying the brain. She spoke to me by Skype from the California Institute of Technology, where she's a visiting professor. You are also part of research, ongoing research, that shows Alzheimer's disease could be the result of microbial infection.
Oh, yes. I was so excited by that paper that came out. Reed had it all in Neurons. But what was really interesting about that paper for me is that the herpes virus they found is the herpes virus that caused roseola, which is a childhood infection that most people think of as a nuisance. Roseola is the slapped cheek happening in children 2 to 3 years old. Almost every kid in the U.S. gets it. And it turns out that this virus is a herpes virus, and it lives in the brain for the rest of your life. So what they found in the Reedhead paper is that there is a quantitative trait locus. In other words, some place on the DNA that they know quantitatively where it is, but they don't know exactly how many genes it involves, that co-segregates with the susceptibility to Alzheimer's disease if you get this virus. So I was fascinated by that because my own work has shown that herpes simplex virus, the virus that causes the cold sore on your lip, can also associate with the Alzheimer's disease pathognomonic proteins, amyloid beta that causes plaques, and phospho-tau that causes neurofibrillary tangles. And that herpes virus interacts with both of these proteins. So I got fascinated that, you know, maybe herpes virus was there in your brain. If you have it on your lip, maybe it gets into your brain and you have it your whole life and then it wakes up and it does something bad. And I had a patient before I moved to UNM at Brown University, young girl, who'd gotten herpes virus when she was born and was treated. And it never actually went away. And so when at age 6, it was still growing in her brain. We thought she had a tumor. We did a biopsy, found herpes virus. She's been treated for the virus, but now she's got learning deficits and hyperactivity and all sorts of behavioral problems because of this virus.
This kind of research could be a huge impact on Alzheimer's research, but you're finding impacts even in young children.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
And how the brain grows. You know, it's all, our brain is developing until, well, probably still in me, some cells, some neurons are still being born and migrating up and forming new connections. And according to the most of the literature on the limbic system, our limbic system is still learning until we die. So learning a memory doesn't stop in the limbic emotional system. While it does slow down a lot in our mathematical parts of our brain, where it's kind of hard to learn new equations as you age. But you can still do it. It's just harder.
This idea of infections being a catalyst for the onset of Alzheimer's is, as you say, it's gaining a lot of attention and traction. There's a $1 million prize now focused on clarifying if the disease is caused by a germ. If these theories prove true, what would it mean for treating or even preventing Alzheimer's?
Well, yeah. So the whole Alzheimer's community has been totally anti the infectious disease idea. And part of why I stopped working so hard on the HSV and Alzheimer's connection was the enormous amount of acrimonious feedback I got from members of the Alzheimer's community. But now it's becoming more and more clear. And Rudy Tanzi, who was the second to last author in that paper I quoted, he discovered the A-beta parent protein, amyloid precursor protein, and he's at Harvard and he's very well respected. And now he is coming towards the idea that infections could play a role. Many different infections probably play a role. The plaques are probably a response to inflammation, and anything that will induce inflammation in the brain may cause a plaque. So we need to start looking at neuronal inflammation and astroglial and microglial responses to understand where sporadic cases of Alzheimer's come from. One of my theses has been that early infection can lead to things having a long time in your body to get to your brain. And they're in there for 60 years. They get 60 years to make it from your gut to your brain. And then they start setting up an inflammatory response and whoa, there you go. You've got Alzheimer's. So I take a lifespan view of Alzheimer's, and I think we need to start prevention in childhood.
Given that now there's these theories are gaining more currency in the Alzheimer's community, are you going to be focusing more on that or continue to focus on it?
Yeah. One of the other projects I have right now working on is a neuropathology project. I've collected 20-some postmortem brains from around the world of people who have died from herpes simplex encephalitis, which is a massive infection in the brain of herpes, and the person dies from it. And I have these slides laid out on the desk next to my microscope, and I'm working with people at Oxford in England and somebody in Oregon and somebody back at Rhode Island and a couple of people at UNM to look at these brains and say, okay, here's a huge amount of herpes simplex. They died from the infection. Did they make plaque? Did they make A-beta? Do they have phospho-tau? Do they have any of the pathognomonic signatures of Alzheimer's disease? And some do and some don't. So now I'm trying to figure out why would it happen to some people with this encephalitis and not to others?
So who is working? You're not working on your own. You've got a team with you at UNM.
Exactly, yes. My team has had great luck this fall in that we've got three platform talks at Society for Neuroscience. I'm chairing a session, and we have one poster session. A postdoc in my lab, Dan Bartow, is funded by this ACERT program that Angela Wandiger-Ness runs to train a postdoctor fellows to be both teachers and scientists. And Dan is going to present our work on early life stress in the mouse models and show how the brain's response to fear is fundamentally changed by those early experiences and by the lack of the serotonin transporter, which is the target of Prozac. And then I have Daniel Perez Rodriguez, and he is helping Janet Page Reeves and I with the hair cortisol project, looking at stress. And Christopher Medina, Cherokee Hispanic, BAMD. He's published three papers with me, and he's been invited to give a platform talk at Society for Neuroscience on our Alzheimer's project. And then there's Alden Ray Harrison Riviere, who's a post-bac hoping to get into medical school, who's been supporting everybody in the lab to get their work done, particularly the brain imaging projects.
You sound quite busy, Professor Bearer. So I'm interested to know how you find time to compose music.
You know, people have asked me that over the years, and I really don't know. While I'm talking to you, I'm also listening to music in my head. I hear music in my head all the time. The challenge for me has been to find the time to write it down. So composing, it's not the problem. Actually writing it down in a way that somebody can read it and play it is finding that time's a little hard. And so one of the things I try to do is set up digital ways to enter the music rapidly so that I can play it in as fast as it plays in my head. But then there's all the editing. And one of the things I've really failed at is getting the – I've had many performances. Last year I had 3 new pieces performed with very big audiences. I haven't done anything to post them on YouTube. I haven't done anything to put them on my website. I mean, it's like I don't have time for the marketing aspects of it. I just write the music.
So you're hearing music all the time. Is that not distracting, or does this somehow like weave into what you're doing as a scientist and inform it?
So I know that some people listen to music when they're working. It's like having a radio on, I guess. Some people leave music playing in their office all the time.
But it's your own personal radio station in your head.
Yeah, it's my own personal radio station. And then when I go out, I walk to the bathroom, I go out, get a cup of coffee, I focus on it a little more and I listen to it, or I focus on whatever problem in neuroscience I've been working on. And I think about that, or I think about both at the same time. I don't know.
Do they help one another, or is it hard to parse that out?
You know, that's another question that a lot of people have asked me. And I do know one thing. When I was in Bruce Albert's lab at UCSF as a postdoc, Bruce, who's remained a really good friend, I just wrote a piece for his 80th birthday. Bruce said, Elaine, you have to focus. You know, you have to stop writing this music and just focus on the science. So I thought, okay, maybe I should try that. So I tried it. And you know what? I couldn't think science if I didn't think also music. I just couldn't think. So it didn't work. I couldn't put aside the music, but I can put aside the writing it down. So I can suspend writing it down. So what ends up happening is I have to memorize my pieces because I never have time to write them down. And that makes them better, I think. My music, I've been listening to some of my past music because I'm trying to get stuff ready to put on YouTube. And I think my music has improved over the years. The slower it takes me to write it down, the better the piece is. I guess that makes sense.
Well, Professor Elaine Barrow, this has just been fascinating. So I think you probably should donate your brain to science when the time comes, because it sounds like it's pretty unique.
I don't know about that. I've been trying to get my hands on Einstein's brain for a while. You know, there's a pathologist who has it in New Jersey. The pathologist was at Rutgers who has his brain. I think it would have been very interesting to look at that.
Most definitely. Well, thank you so much for talking with us on University Showcase.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Elaine Barrow. She's a neuropathologist at the UNM School of Medicine, and she's also a composer. She mentioned the annual Child Well-Being Symposium presented by the UNM Health Sciences Center, and she says the 2019 symposium will likely take place in February or March. Now we continue our discussions about the brain with our segment featuring research at UNM you probably haven't heard about.
Nobody's ever gonna read this!
This is Marty Adam Smith, afternoon freeform host, in the studio with David Bridwell of the University of New Mexico affiliated Mind Research Institute. How are you doing today, David?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. What is the Mind Research Network, and what are you guys working on now?
Yeah, so MRN is affiliated with the University of New Mexico, and we're doing a lot of research that focuses on all the different brain measures that we can collect, like fMRI, EEG, and genetics. How can we combine all those measures to better understand the brain of people who've been diagnosed with schizophrenia and depression and various clinical populations to predict symptoms and predict response to treatment and things like that?
Well, very cool. And your background is a PhD in cognitive science from the University of California at Irvine, right?
Yep, cognitive neuroscience.
Cognitive neuroscience. Very
yeah.
cool.
Mm-hmm.
And in your current research group, are you all cognitive scientists or neuroscientists?
Actually, it's a lot of engineers.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And it turns out if you want to understand the brain, you have to get people from very diverse backgrounds. So you have computer scientists collaborating with engineers, with cognitive neuroscientists to try to integrate all those different tools to understand it.
So, yeah, these are very technically difficult problems to solve. Like, what is the tool that you used in your most recent publication on the relationships between alpha oscillations during speech preparation and listener N400 ERP to that produced speech?
Yeah, well, since my background is EEG, which is where you place a sensor on the scalp and you...
And what does that stand for?
Electroencephalography.
Ah, thanks.
Yeah, you just place a sensor on the scalp and you measure synchronous brain activity from the outer parts of the brain, from the cortex. And you can set this up within minutes and just be recording people's brain measures. So it's very surprising and interesting that brain electrical activity actually propagates through the skull and onto the scalp. So most of the analysis of that data is time series analysis because it's just fluctuations of voltage across time.
And so N400, that refers to 400 milliseconds?
Yeah, there are these stereotypical peaks that you see in EEG. Mm-hmm. So you'll present some visual thing or some auditory, a word. And then there, if you average across multiple presentations, then there's these stereotypical peaks. So it turns out if you have people listen to words, like if they're listening to language, there's a peak around 400 milliseconds in electrical activity that follows every single word.
Okay.
So the brain is constantly tracking. And we can, with speech, it's like on the order of 160 words per minute. Mm-hmm. With reading, it's like 200 words per minute. We're constantly tracking it. And it's just incredible that the brain can process the stimuli the way it does. So we leveraged this stereotypical peak following every word. And the fact that when it's an unexpected word, it's actually a larger peak.
And your example for an unexpected word, like the sentence is, I took my dog for a walk, right? And that's highly expected. And your example of an unexpected sentence was, I took my dog for a drink.
So
and what difference did you see in those two conditions of related sentences with one being much more predictable than the other?
So when it's much more unpredictable, like I took my dog for a, and you expect the word walk to come up, but drink comes up instead, there's a much more negative peak around 400 milliseconds.
And negative means a stronger response, more electrical
basically,
activity?
Yeah, basically there's a process in the brain that's getting more engaged because something that you didn't expect happened. So there's this sort of cascade of processes that are involved in how do I process this new thing that I didn't expect? So we actually showed that when somebody is preparing that word, that there's a brain measure of more engagement. So the more effort that they do in terms of coming up with an unexpected word is correlated with a larger brain response within the listener to that prepared word. So the amount of effort between two participants is related to each other, which you would expect for successful communication.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Well, very cool. Thanks so much for coming in.
Awesome. Thank you.
That was Marty Adamsmith with David Bridwell of the Mind Research Network. You can hear this and all our previous University Showcase episodes at KUNM.org. Thanks to our guests, and thanks to Dr. David Bashwinner at the UNM School of Music for composing our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.